Starting your own private medical practice can be the most exciting and rewarding thing you'll ever do in your career, but at the same time, it can be so daunting. Where do you start and how? That's why Gentem Health put together the podcast series, Journey to Private Practice, where we document and interview entrepreneurs, clinicians, investors, and the best in the industry to bring you actionable insights as how to start, grow, and scale your private practice. With insights tailored just for you, and actionable links in the notes, this is the Journey to Private Practice. Hey, podcast listeners, this is Omar Khatib, your host for Journey to Private Practice. And we have another webinar audio, this one for all you medical coders out there. Now, when it comes to medical coding, there's a lot of places where you might trip up. And one of those places is diagnosis codes, right? Some are more expensive errors than others, and so being able to recognize them and fix them is really half, if not all, the battle. And so to talk about that, we reached out to medical coding influencer and instructor Victoria Mall. She's the founder of Contempo Coding. Victoria is extremely passionate about providing engaging and cost-effective education. She has multi-specialty experience in professional coding and auditing and risk adjustment coding, and has published numerous articles on coding and billing, along with best practices, and has spoke at several local, regional, and national events, including HealthCon, the National Business of Healthcare Expo, and others. She's been featured on the Alpha Coding Podcast and Not Elsewhere Classified Podcast, and also has her own extremely dynamic YouTube channel, which is how I found her, which is filled with all kinds of free coding tips and tricks. Just look up Victoria Mall Contempo Coding on YouTube and subscribe to her channel. And she also serves on the AAPC Chapter Association Board of Directors and has been doing that for years 2021 going to 2023, and is currently on the editorial board for the BC Advantage magazine. So here's the audio for that webinar. If you're interested in seeing the webinars, you can see the slides itself. Just head over to gentem.com/webinars or check the show notes below for all the goodies and show links. Hey, and speaking of goodies, because, you know, everybody loves goodies, right? For all you medical coders out there, you know, being an integral part of the practice, not just medical coding, is what makes you just completely indispensable and, of course, extremely valuable. So whether it's your medical practice or another medical coder's practice, find ways to help them outside of just medical coding. And one of those ways is with the billing, reimbursement, and, of course, access to capital, aka getting money to grow the practice. So if you know a practice that needs help with this, send them to Gentem and have them sign up for a free demo and, of course, a billing and reimbursement analysis, and have them mention your name, perhaps with your email. Because if they become a Gentem customer, you get $1,000 from Gentem, right? Not bad. Imagine all the ways you can use that $1,000. Maybe going to a new course. Hey, maybe buying some fun stuff on Amazon. So, but either way, however you want to spend it is up to you. So if you know any practice in need, send them over to gentem.com and have them sign up for the free demo and billing benchmark assessment. So here is their webinar with Victoria Mall. Enjoy. We can get started. So hi, everyone. My name is Omar Khatib. I'm the head of growth here at Gentem Health. And this is another one of our special private practice growth webinar series. Now, when I joined Gentem, you know, the one thing I needed to start learning a little bit more about was, you know, not only reimbursement, but medical coding. And this is kind of a very difficult, tough topic. And so I went online to search and I came across this fantastic YouTube channel and amazing resource, which is Victoria Mall of Contempo Coding. You know, I'm not a medical coder, but even for me, I found her content so compelling, educational, and it taught me a lot. And so I had to have her on. I was lucky enough to interview on her on our podcast, which we'll be releasing that episode soon, and I'll share that with everybody. But I told her, I said, Victoria, I feel like you have to come on and give a webinar for us. So she put together this fantastic slide deck I'm really looking forward to. And what's even better is we're going to have a live Q&A. So while you guys are watching the webinar, and live that is, go ahead and look in your dashboard. You can either go to chat and leave a question there. You can go to Q&A. You can ask a question there. Or if you're extra brave, raise your hand and I'll actually bring you in live, either through audio or video or both. And you can ask Victoria yourself any burning question you have about medical coding. So with that being said, I'm going to do a quick short presentation just about Gentem. We have a couple of special offers for all you medical coders, and then we'll get right into the main event. So Let me just quickly share, and I'm going to ask Victoria to confirm that you can see my, can you see my screen, Victoria?
Absolutely, I can.
Great, great. So the problem that Gentem is solving is that private medical practices, they struggle with the complexity and unpredictability of reimbursements, right? And the problem with this, and it's something that's very close to my heart, is that my father even was a surgeon with his own private practice for over 35 years. And reimbursements has always been a difficult thing. Luckily for him, you know, and I think every great practice has that one medical coder that finds a way to make the reimbursement work, but it doesn't happen all the time. You know, when you look at a medical practice, there's a lot of key players in the revenue cycle. You have the patient, the healthcare provider, the insurance payer, you know, and the billing company. And your traditional revenue cycle and reimbursement pathway looks like this. We all know this, which is extremely complicated. The registration, the charge capture, claim statuses, and a practice, especially a private medical practitioner. Think about, you know, the surgeon in your local town or a small family primary care practice. They have to do all this in-house, or they try and contract it out, and it's very difficult. This is where Gentem comes in. We're trying to revive private medical practices and help providers stay independent. We were founded by a Stanford-educated physician and a former Facebook software engineer. What we found was that when you uncover hidden revenue in your claims, that's the key to increasing your cash flow and staying independent. And we do that through what's called predictive reimbursement modeling on our platform. We have a platform that helps do this, and as well as a tech-enabled service of certified billers and revenue cycle managers. Mission's very simple. We want to simplify, accelerate, and increase reimbursement so private medical practices can stay independent and focus on patients. And if we achieve our vision, these private medical practices are revived, and it helps them stay independent because, in my opinion, the best quality care that you get as a patient is when you go to your doctor in their office and not hogging the wheel in these massive corporate-run hospitals. So what we try to do is bring that, you know, source of billing in-house for these practices so they have transparency of reporting and their data-driven results. So you take this traditional revenue cycle pathway, and this is what it looks like with Gentem. All these little green circles are things that Gentem's platform and service take care of. And so the physician and the practice really focus on, you know, charge capture and coding, patient follow-up and payment. And so, of course, that first and really important part of charge capture and coding is what you all are here for, and you're going to learn from the very best. This is an example of one of our dashboards. And again, if you're interested in learning more, go to our website. We'd love for you to play around and check it out. It's a very interesting dashboard. This is just one of many things. And, you know, because we're dealing with a lot of data-driven reimbursements, we build other financial growth products. One is Gentem Advanced. So as a doctor, like when my dad opened a practice, he had to go get a bank loan. We tell our physicians, don't go get a bank loan, leverage upfront payments for your claims. So there's no credit check or long application. We base this based off of insurance claims reimbursements, and it's ideal for growing practices. We also have Gentem buy AR, where we essentially buy your old and aging AR. Now, last thing I want to share is we launched a new resource, which is this, how much revenue is your practice losing? So if you go to gentem.com/lost revenue, you have this free calculator. You don't have to enter anything. You don't have to enter email or anything. And you can see your at-risk AR, your net collection rates. It's a really great tool to benchmark because we use the Medical Group Management Association's data to show you how your practice is doing. And the last two slides, and I'll hand it over to Victoria. One is we have this special offer for private practices, which is we do this free revenue and billing benchmark assessment, plus a technology demo to see like how Gentem could potentially be helpful for you. And for any practice that signs up before June 30th, you're getting your first month of free, you know, for free, which think about how much you can use those funds. You can use it in marketing. You can use it to hire new staff. Maybe, you know, there's a lot of ways you can do this. And the last offer just for the medical coding audience, if you refer a practice and they become a customer, you get $1,000 when they become a Gentem customer. So it's a great deal. All you have to do is go to gentem.com or refer a practice to there. Tell them about the free benchmark assessment. We'll do it. And our sales team, as well as me, will make sure to ask who referred them. If it's you, we will reach out through email and you get $1,000. And hey, you know, $1,000 these days, I know that from the pandemic, we still like to buy a lot of fun stuff on Amazon. So think about the many ways you can use that. So that being said, enough of the pitch. Let's get straight to the main show. So Victoria, the floor is yours. And just to remind everybody, questions and comments, leave them in the chat and I'll be monitoring them. So
There we go.
I can hear you and see you, so you're good.
I was pressing the wrong buttons there. Let me just quick bring up my participant list in my chat so I can see everything going on. Okay. So hello, everyone. I'm excited to be here today to talk about diagnosis coding and how expensive mistakes can be made just based off of diagnosis coding alone. I'm Victoria Mull. I'm a medical coder, auditor, educator, and content creator, most popularly known for my YouTube channel, Contempo Coding. I am certified through the American Academy of Professional Coders, or what used to be called the American Academy of Professional Coders. Now it's just called the AAPC. I'm a certified coder, auditor, risk adjustment coder. I'm a licensed instructor, certified outpatient coder, and I specialize in plastic and reconstructive surgery coding. I am certified in that since 2013. I've done lots of publications for Healthcare Business Monthly, way more than what's even listed here, but these are the more prominent ones. I work a lot with local chapters, not only serving on boards for the local chapters, but I also serve on a national level on the National Board of Directors for years 2020 through 2022. And I've spoken locally, regionally, nationally at a lot of different medical coding seminars, regional conferences, and national conferences as well. Today I'm here because I want to talk about our diagnosis coding, some of the things that might be coming up with diagnosis coding, things to look at, and where you could possibly be leaking some potential revenue when you're not getting diagnosis coding correct. So we're going to talk about what is ICD-10-CM, why they matter more so these past few years than they have maybe in previous years. I'm going to talk a little bit about how they impact the quality programs and the HCCs, some of the common errors that I've just seen across a lot of practices, and then how we can improve our documentation to make sure that we're leading it to the right diagnosis code. So ICD-10-CM, we implemented it back in October 1st of 2015. Prior to that, we were on ICD-9. So when it comes to ICD-10, what does that stand for? It's the International Classification of Diseases 10th Revision Clinical Modification. And in different countries, they use different versions of ICD-10-CM. So that CM clinical modification is one that we use in the United States. They use different ones in Australia. They use different ones in the Netherlands. There's different versions of ICD-10. They're essentially based off of the same code set, but little different variations. So when it comes to ICD-10-CM, you know, we still have our tried and true ICD-10-CM code books, but there's also a lot of applications that are available from various vendors. Now, when we're talking about code lookup, you know, I'm still, and a lot of people are still, they like their paper books, but I understand how convenient it is too to have something to look up things in an EMR or on your phone. I would just caution you that if you're using something like an app that you found on the Play Store or on the Apple Store, be careful that it's a trusted vendor, because a lot of people these days can just make applications. The difference between ICD-10-CM versus a CPT is ICD-10-CM is free use. So you can go and download the whole book. Anyone can use it. You can manipulate it. You can make apps based off of it, and you don't have to pay royalties, versus CPT, which is owned by the AMA, and they don't like people publishing, you know, their data files and so forth without having to pay them licensing fees. So you might find some people that have published applications of ICD-10-CM code lookup, but maybe they're outdated, they haven't kept up with them, maybe they're directing you to inaccurate code selections. So just make sure that you're working with trusted vendors for some of those lookup tools. The other thing that's interesting about ICD-10-CM is that there is actually pages and pages and pages of guidelines. So I can actually show you in my book here. Just give me one second to switch over. On my book here, and we have to do this fun flip thing where I flip and flip and flip and flip because it doesn't let you select the right camera when you're sharing from a second camera. Here we go. Hold on. There we go. So there's pages and pages and pages of ICD-10-CM coding guidelines. So at the front of my book, for example, here's all the guidelines about how we sequence ICD-10-CM codes, how they go into order, when to use signs and symptoms, when you can code based off a definitive diagnosis, laterality. There's tons of chapter-specific guidelines, even here as far as how we code for HIV, how we code for urosepsis, And there's just so much information that if you're just looking at something at a simple lookup tool, you might not get the correct code because it might not be feeding based off of some specific guidelines that are in the ICD-10 CM book. So even just not just the guidelines in the front, but throughout the book, there's little guidelines that give you these tips about, hey, we need you to code an additional code, maybe the type of infection. We need you to include that this patient is a smoker or has exposure to tobacco products. We need you to code something else first. And the insurance companies have these type of guidelines oftentimes programmed into their thought process as well. So they're looking for certain diagnoses to be coded first or to a higher specificity. And if that's not included, that could potentially trigger a denial, those sequencing issues that we have because of those guidelines in ICD-10-CM. So what do we use these ICD-10-CM codes for? Well, a lot of people think reimbursement. That's the first thing we think of, right? Like we need those diagnoses so that it supports the CPT code so that we get paid. It supports that medical necessity component, right? And I have a lot of people that will say to me, oh, well, Victoria, as a medical coder, aren't you worried that if we go on federally funded healthcare that you'll be out of a job because we'll just all get paid for everything? Well, you also have to understand there's more purposes to these diagnosis codes than just reimbursement. I mean, that's the first thing we think of, but also things like tracking and trending disease outbreaks. You know, we don't track the narrative of the diagnosis, we track it via the code, even monitoring the disease process. So if we have a ICD-10-CM code like E11.9, patient has uncomplicated diabetes, you know, that uncomplicated diabetes has a lot of things it could evolve into, right? It could evolve into diabetic nephropathy, diabetic retinopathy, diabetic gangrene, and we track that with our diagnosis code. So we can look and say, okay, let's search for E11.9, see how many of those E11.9 patients in the past year developed a complication, which we identify with our codes, or and then if they didn't develop a complication, okay, well, why did these patients not develop complications? Were they seen by their PCP more? Were they receiving certain medications? You know, what happened to the data here? And then just tracking costs. So even though maybe we're not paid as heavily on ICD-10 as we are on CPT, we can look at that and go, oh, well, patients that have these diagnosis codes, how much healthcare costs are they using? So our E11.9 patients, what's their average annual cost of care based off of that diagnosis code? And then we can even start predicting things. Okay, our E11.9 patients are diabetic uncomplicated. How many complications are they going to develop and how much is that going to wind up costing us in the future? That's where they can start making some of those calculations and saying, hey, you know, this is how much money we're going to need in the Medicare fund for the next 5 years, the next 10 years, because we can track that disease process. We can track how much as that disease progresses, it's going to cost us in the future. But you know, we've a lot of times thought about it as the support of the medical necessity. When I first got into the revenue cycle, I started out in charge entry. So I just had a whole bunch of super bills on one screen and my practice management system on the other. And I would just type in everything that was on the super bill all day. And my boss said, you know, Victoria, there's three important things you need to learn getting into billing, getting into revenue cycle. And the first was, she said, get the money up front. So collect those copays. She came from working the front office and she knew that if she didn't collect a copay on a patient and they walked out that door, she might never get that copay. And it would be very ineffective to keep sending letters. Hey, you forgot your $10, $15, $20 copay. And they'd probably wind up spending more time having to follow up on that than they would just collecting that $20 up front, right? So that was the first thing she wanted me to know, collect the money up front. Number two was RVU is king, because we were in a big healthcare organization. A lot of the providers were paid via their RVU. So RVU was king, made sure you got this right CPT with the big RVU so that the provider could get all the money that they were entitled to. And the third thing she wanted me to learn was that it only takes one diagnosis code to pay a claim. And right, wrong, or otherwise, that's kind of the mentality we've had about diagnosis codes for years. We've not given them as much weight as our CPT codes because we've been paid for so long in fee for service. You do this service, you get X amount of dollars, and that's the end of it. But now that's starting to change a little bit. And I'll talk about that more as we go on. So coverage determinations, that's a big one with ICD-10-CM. So coverage determinations, and I'm going to talk a lot about Medicare. I still kind of use that as my gold standard. And it's important to be familiar with these coverage determinations because that's the things like, hey, these CPT codes are going to get paid if the patient has these diagnosis codes. Now, it's important to be familiar with the coverage determinations and also subscribe to the payer updates, because while there's some great software out there that will give you information on the coverage determinations, the national coverage determinations, the local coverage determinations right at the tip of your fingers, they might not give you information like this. And this was something that came up just recently through an update that I was sent. And it says that they are going to be currently updating their policy on cosmetic and reconstructive surgery. And that's going to be effective July 11th. So if there's something in here that maybe I used to be covered for and now they're not going to cover it, or vice versa, maybe they haven't been covering it and now they're adding it in, I wouldn't know about that until maybe months later if I wasn't keeping an eye on some of these updates. So it tells us on the information there that this, it says that notice is going to end and that they're going to be updating that new policy with these different types of services for July 11th. So a quick lookup tool, you know, that might not give you some of that information about those upcoming updates. Now, I talked about fee-for-service. So fee-for-service is basically the provider renders a service and they get paid their approved contracted fee. And regardless of the quality of that outcome, that provider gets the same fee. So if you're a really awesome provider, you do amazing healthcare with your patients, they come in, they say, hey, I've got heart palpitations, you get them on the right medication, you say, hey, you need to cut back on your sodium, you need to exercise a little bit more, you need to get on this plan, you print out a summary for them, you make sure they're following up, you bill out a 99214 and you get like $125. Woohoo. But what happens then is a provider who maybe is just having a rough day, they aren't following up, they didn't realize maybe the patient has a language barrier so they can't read their after visit summary. Maybe the EMR was malfunctioning, they missed something, that patient doesn't have as good of an outcome. Well, they still bill their 99214, they still get $125. Now that landscape is starting to change a little bit. Now we have things like the CMS Quality Payment Program, where depending on your election, you might get increases in your fee schedule or decreases in your fee schedule based off of different quality measures. And part of those quality measures is identifying your high-risk patients through their diagnosis codes. So if you're doing really good, instead of getting $125, you might get $130, $135. If you're not having as good outcomes, you know, you might be getting a little bit less on your fee schedule, or you might not be eligible for a certain bonus. And this isn't just Medicare. Now we're seeing a lot of our commercial insurances. I've seen some contracts with commercial insurances where they say, you know, we have these quality payment programs and we're going to give you certain bonuses based off of their quality measures, based off of reporting them out. And effectively, everyone's kind of working towards the same sort of goal. You know, the hospital is the biggest, most expensive hotel in America, and we want to keep patients out of there. We don't want them getting to the point where they've got a severe exacerbation or they've been prolonging things so long that now they're at the ER and they're getting admitted. We want to keep them in at their appropriate medical practices, make sure that their conditions are under control. We're providing really good care. We keep those costs down. And that's what really feeds that. And a lot of it is identifying also that these patients are really high risk. We're anticipating that they probably will going to go to the hospital. They are going to cost a lot. But if we keep those costs down for those patients that are predicted to cost a lot, that's where those bonus monies come in. And you have to look at the CMS website, look at your payer contracts, because a lot of those commercial contracts now are saying, hey, you know, based off of your quality scores, which includes diagnosis coding, you can get some additional monies. So ICD-10-CM, there are currently over 73,000 ICD-10-CM codes. Now, most providers only utilize a small portion of them. You're not going to have to know all 73,000. And depending on your specialty, it may be a fairly narrow scope. You know, if we go back to the old Superbill days, you used to have just a selection of them. You might have in your EMR like a pick list, like these are the top 20, 30 diagnoses that my patients have. Just a heads up though, ICD-11 is going to have actually four times 4 times this amount, but that's going to be a while yet till we convert. I know a lot of people are panicked because they've said that ICD-11 is going to be available for use January 1 of next year, but available for use versus being implemented are two totally different things. So if you think back to when we went from I-9 to I-10, it was, I believe, available for use in the 1980s. And then wasn't used until 2015 in the United States. So I would say at minimum, it's going to be 5 years, but there's going to be a long time for that conversion because there's a lot of changes that have to go through. All of those insurance policies, all of those updates, there's going to be national testing standards that have to change because the thought process is because it is so big, they won't be publishing it on books anymore. And in order to become a certified coder, you actually have to have paper books at your test. So they're going to have to change that whole testing process. There's just so much that even has to just even start being looked at before we make that transition. So even though it's available for use, that means we could use it if we wanted to on January 1. It's not going to happen, I don't think, for quite a period of time. Other countries, I'm sure, will be way ahead of the United States. Now, of those 73,000, there are 11,000 ICD-10-CM codes that map to what we call an HCC, a hierarchical conditional category. So these are ones that Medicare has said, yeah, we know these are the expensive codes. We know these are the ones that the patients are going to go to the hospital. They're going to need a lot of medications. They're going to be at their PCP every other day. And these are the ones that they identify for these quality metrics are going to pay more. And if you think, first off, let me talk about our Advantage plans, our Medicare Advantage plans. So what it used to be is, you know, prior to the Affordable Care Act, we would have these patients that we would say, hey, we're not going to enroll you in our plan, or we can't enroll you unless you pay a huge amount, or we're going to exclude these certain diagnoses. And then when the Affordable Care Act came in, they said, hey, we don't want you to not enroll people into healthcare. Like, everyone should be able to have healthcare and health insurance. But they can't just say, oh, well, you have to enroll everyone, because they'll lose money, because the Medicare Advantage plans, the replacement plans, are partially funded by the Medicare funds. So if they're taking care of these expensive patients and they don't have that much money, they're going to go out of business, right? So now these Medicare Advantage plans get risk adjusted. They say, hey, out of these 11,000 codes, we know that these are the expensive ones. So report them out once a year and we'll give you a higher rate. And hopefully, of course, then that additional money the insurance company gets is going to trickle down to the provider. And then, of course, there's this also quality payment programs and different quality bonuses you might get based off of these diagnoses that map to these HCCs, these hierarchical conditional categories. And basically, it's just like a group of diagnoses. And I'll show you a couple of examples as we go through. And more patients are enrolling into these Medicare Advantage plans. Right now in 2020, it's over a third of patients, and that's predicted to go up. So that's another thing to consider. You know, people say, oh, well, what if we go on to this federally funded healthcare? Well, you know, most of these patients that are getting Medicare for quote unquote free, they're electing to pay extra to get into a replacement plan. So even if we have federally funded baseline, it's likely that patients can still elect to get a Capital Blue Cross program or still elect to get into an Aetna program. So HCCs is a hierarchical conditional category, and that's a classification mechanism that we take these ICD-10-CM codes that we go, hey, these are kind of similar, we'll group them together. And there's numbers of these HCCs. So they'll say, hey, we'll group these all together. They're similar in cost, similar in risk, and we'll assign them this HCC. So they have a similar resource utilization, similar risk, and the higher risk diagnoses have more money attached to them. So what is an HCC? So here's an example. HCC 29 is chronic hepatitis. And in that grouping of 29 HCC, we have chronic viral hepatitis, which is category B18. We have category K73, which is chronic hepatitis not elsewhere classified. And then we have K75.4, which is autoimmune hepatitis. So they've grouped them all together saying, hey, these are all going to go in HCC 29. And this is approximately how much these are going to give as far as a fact. There's all kinds of algorithms and stuff they do with the payments that are associated with them. So they give them like a little numerical value of how much they pay capitated rates for the Medicare Advantage, how much this can possibly go into your quality payment program. But really just reporting out those high-risk diagnoses is really the key, like once a year. And they're weighted differently. So for example, going back to our E11.9, our uncomplicated diabetes patient, they will have a risk adjustment factor. But the patients that have more complications have a risk adjustment or an HCC that pays more, right? Because that's more complicated. So if you look at this HCC though, HCC 29 is chronic hepatitis. So we need to have on there, because these are the different chronic hepatitis. If we just say hepatitis, but don't specify chronic, it's not going to meet this criteria. So there's those little nuances in diagnosis coding documentation that can really impact whether or not this is going to be one of those diagnoses that has an HCC and there's potentially some extra funds in there or not. Now, we have a lot of things like problem lists that sometimes we just pull in the whole problem list. It might be old things on the problem list. How do we differentiate what is being, what's okay for a diagnosis that'll pass through an audit if it's reviewed by our insurance policies and they say, oh yeah, well, you definitely did something. Like, we can't just list the diagnosis. We can't just go one, congestive heart failure, two, HIV, three, lung cancer. You know, there has to be something to evaluate that that diagnosis was managed or treated in some way. And we use this criteria called MEET. So MEET is manage, evaluate, assess, or address, or treat. And that means you have to designate in the documentation that you did something with this diagnosis. You didn't just look at it and go, oh yeah, well, I'm just plopping this on the documentation. We managed it. We prescribed a medication. We evaluated it. Evaluate could even be, are you seeing your nephrologist and going to your dialysis appointments routinely? So that could be just something that's a little bit of an evaluation, or you assessed it. It could even be a simple statement like stable. Just that word stable is the minimum requirement that you can scrape by and say that it will meet that criteria for those quality payment programs for addressing that diagnosis. Now, obviously it would be better if you said they're stable on their current medication regimen of metformin, but just that little statement of stable will sometimes just scrape you right through. So problem lists. I have seen a myriad of issues with problem lists, especially when they're things like shared EMRs. So what happens is these problem lists, you know, you add things in depending on functionality, they might get kind of bloated, right? You might see on there when you're pulling in your problem list that the patient has a UTI. Well, that patient had that UTI 5 years ago. Somehow it got on the problem list. Now it's going on the claim forms and the documentation. It's going out the door. So sometimes there's a little bit of cleanup work that needs to be done with those problem lists. It can be daunting depending on how much and how shared that EMR is that bloat is happening on the problem list. Sometimes that EMR functionality can lead to just clogged problem lists. And there may be things even on the problem list that are historical, though, that can still be abstracted. So there are some things that maybe even though the patient doesn't actively have it, there might still be a diagnosis code for it, right? Like maybe a history of cancer, or there's a code for an old myocardial infarction, because that patient that had that myocardial infarction might be at risk for another one. So we track that through our diagnosis coding. So problem lists, I know if they're very daunting, just try to clean them up kind of as you go with the patients coming in, you know, verify or even have the staff verify, do you still have this diagnosis? Do you still have this diagnosis? You know, are you still being treated for this? And have that problem list cleaned up so that if you need to do something like they're coming in for an annual wellness visit and you're dropping in that whole problem list because you want to capture all those high-risk diagnoses and you're organizing them appropriately, you know, you don't want to be filtering through a lot of stuff as a provider when your time is better spent actually treating the patient. Now, the claim forms were updated a few years ago. So it used to be that they only would hold four diagnosis codes. And I still encounter a lot of providers that are like, oh, well, I'm only going to pick the top four because that's all that the can go out on the claim. Well, actually, the claim form, the CMS 1500, can have up to 12 diagnosis coding. Now, with coding, the first diagnosis should usually be the presenting problem. Like, what is the biggest thing that patient is getting treated for the day? Why did they come in the door and receive healthcare services? And then there are certain sequencing guidelines as far as if you code these two together, like this should go first, this should go second. But in absence of those couple of nuances, we should really try to push, if they have a long, long list, push those higher risk, those HCC diagnoses to those top 12 spots. Because really what feeds a lot of this data is them going out on the claim form once per year. And actually it resets every year. So say, for example, you have a patient that has a below the knee amputation. That is something that has an HCC, it risk adjusts, but it has to get reported out as that diagnosis code once every year. Even though we know the limb didn't grow back, it still has to get on the claim form, submitted out to the insurance in order to say that you addressed it at least once a year. A great time to do this is, like I said, if you're in a primary care practice and you do annual wellness visits, like that's the time, the patient's coming in and they know this is going to be a long visit and they're going to go through a whole lot of stuff. So that's the time you can really just capture that and go, hey, let's take everything. We're going to go through it and I'm going to address it. See if, you know, you're seeing a specialist, if you're still on your medication, if you're still having problems, and take that time to really go through everything and make sure that those HCCs are at the top. Some of the EMRs I've seen are pretty handy with that. I've seen some that'll at least have an icon that they'll say, yeah, this is one that has an HCC. Make sure you use this diagnosis, trying to point it to the top 12 spots. I've seen others that there's even functionalities, I believe in like some of our higher EMRs like Epic, that it will pop something up if you program it appropriately that says, hey, you haven't reported out this diagnosis in the past year. And it's something that is risk adjusted. And did you address this today? If so, make sure you get it on the claim form, you document it, et cetera. Now, some of the problems we can run into are things like history of. Most providers are clinically trained that in their HPI, they present everything as a history. They say, hey, patient comes in and they have a history of hepatitis and lung nodules and congestive heart failure and all kinds of different diagnoses. And if we look at those coding guidelines that I mentioned, that from a coding standpoint means that those conditions no longer exist. So there's a coding guideline that says we're supposed to code all the conditions that exist, but don't code conditions that were previously treated or no longer exist. And that term history of, for coding purposes, means they don't have it anymore, which means we can't code it. Now, if you put somewhere maybe in the assessment and plan that it's active, or you put somewhere in the assessment and plan that it's being treated with medication and that validates that it's active, most insurances will take that. I have seen though some commercial insurances that they will say, oh, well, you said history of, and that means it doesn't exist. And I'm like, well, yeah, but in the assessment and plan, we're giving them medication for that problem. So clearly it's being actively treated. So you could see a little bit of nuances with some of those insurance companies. My suggestion is try and break the habit and just say, instead of saying the patient has a history of congestive heart failure, diabetes, liver nodules, whatever, just say the patient presents today and they have. So instead of saying that it's a history of, just say that they have those conditions. So for example, instead of saying patient presents today with history of diabetes, atrial fibrillation, and depression, just remove the history of, because from a coding purpose, that means those conditions are no longer exist. They are no longer active. Some of the top missed or sometimes underreported diagnoses are things like diabetes with complications. And that could just be underreporting. We see that a lot underreported, that we're using that E11.9. A lot of providers have that memorized. I have that memorized. That was probably one of the first ICD-10 CM codes I had memorized. But oftentimes those patients in a large amount of cases do have some kind of complication. But it gets reported as E11.9 because it's easy to memorize. I've even been in provider meetings talking about audit results, and one of the providers chirped in and said, hey, has anyone been having problems with the EMR because I can't find the right specified diagnosis code? And the physician lead told me to just cover my ears and told everyone to just go ahead and pick E11.9 because it will get the claim out. And that's true. It will absolutely get that out of your list of things to do for the day, get the claim out, but you could potentially be losing some money because those complication codes have higher risk adjustment payments attached to them versus your uncomplicated diabetes. COPD sometimes gets missed, heart arrhythmias, rheumatoid arthritis. These are all high cost diagnoses. BMI and obesity. And this is one that can be a little tricky because, you know, those high morbid obesity codes, those high BMIs, they do risk adjust. And I've seen a lot of EMR functionalities that they'll look at the patient data. It'll pull the BMI, it'll slap it onto their claim form. But the problem happens is that oftentimes it will also put it then on the patient's after visit summary. So the patient's coming in because they had an upper respiratory infection and they go to look at their after visit summary and it says, hey, you're morbidly obese. And the patient gets a little offended. They're like, hey, why do you have to put that on my after visit summary? I came in for an upper respiratory infection. We did not discuss my weight. We did not discuss my obesity. The provider didn't talk about that at all. Why is that on my form? Why is it on my information that was not pertinent at all to my upper respiratory infection? But it is important to get that on because it needs to get reported out once a year if you want to capture that associated risk with that. Congestive heart failure is another one that sometimes get missed. And again, it doesn't always have to be that you're the provider that's treating their congestive heart failure, but did you at least touch it a little bit? Did you say like, oh, I see you have congestive heart failure. Are you seeing a cardiologist? Oh, what's the name of your cardiologist? Are you following up with them? Just making sure like while that patient's there in front of you, like is that being treated by someone? Now, where this can maybe get a little bit confusing is, you know, with the E&M changes we've had in 2021, there's a difference between the problem addressed as far as how we calculate out our E&M level. That is a separate concept as far as reporting out our diagnoses. We can report out diagnoses, but that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to use them as a problem addressed for our E&M level to bump that up. So that E&M level that we based off of what we're actually managing and treating, that can sometimes be a little bit different than our guidelines that say we have to report all of the conditions that coexist and that we're addressing in some way on that day. So some pitfalls, this is a common one. ICD-10-CM assumes a causal relationship between hypertension and heart disease and hypertension and chronic kidney disease. Well, what happens is the provider documents, you know, diagnosis one, hypertension, diagnosis two, chronic kidney disease stage five. Okay, so what happens is it spits out I-10, hypertension, and then it spits out our code for the chronic kidney disease. But we actually don't use I-10 in these situations. We use a different diagnosis code that has a higher risk adjustment factor, and that's hypertensive kidney disease, I-12 instead of I-10. But if the EMR isn't capturing those, that methodology, that thought process isn't there, you don't have a coder looking at that, right? Then you can miss those higher specificity, those more expensive diagnosis codes that you can bill out, possibly get some quality payment program incentives from, possibly get some additional rates from your commercial insurances, depending on how your contracts are written. And that can affect your bottom line. So hypertension and heart disease, hypertension and chronic kidney disease. I-11 is our hypertensive heart disease. I-12 is hypertensive kidney disease. I-13 is hypertensive heart and chronic kidney disease. So the classification presumes that these are all related, even if the provider does not specifically say they are related. So it just assumes if you see hypertension and you see heart disease, they're related. The only way they would not be related and not be coded as related if that documentation specifically says that there is a different reason, that they are not related in any way, shape, or form. So myocardial infarction is another thing. There's guidelines that say that we can use the myocardial infarction code for encounters after the 4-week time frame of when they've had that myocardial infarction. Now, when it's past that 4 weeks, there's a different code that we use, and that is the code I-25.2, an old myocardial infarction. So we don't want to misassociate and put the wrong diagnosis code in. So that code for the current I-12 myocardial infarction can be reported for up to 4 weeks after that patient is still receiving care for their myocardial infarction. So DVTs are another big one. I used to code a lot of hospitalist services. That was one of the first specialties I learned, just hospitalist, hospitalist, hospitalist. And all at the bottom of nearly every hospital and hospitalist encounter, I would see DVT prophylaxis. And I think I may have actually been trained at that time to code it as a DVT because that was just the way in my naivety of a brand new coder. I'm like, okay, they told me when I see DVT prophylaxis, I code that as a DVT. But if that patient doesn't actually have an active DVT, we shouldn't be coding it as a DVT. So just because the patient's receiving blood thinners to prevent a DVT, that doesn't mean that they have an active DVT. So that's a big pitfall that we can see is that sometimes that DVT prophylaxis, even if it's maybe just there's some AI technology in there, that might be looking at that and dropping that code. But it can only be used if that patient is having an active DVT. Now, I like to talk about authoritative resources because there's so much information out there, so much information. And even if from a coding aspect, it gets overwhelming, right? Like when I started out in coding, I didn't even realize that we had these references out there that were official guidance, coding clinic, CPT assist. So these are authoritative guidance, but we have so much information today. We have blogs, we have podcasts, we have webinars, we have even some of our social media that people put on all kinds of stuff. And some of it, I'm like, So, you know, even your vendors, they'll put out blogs and a lot of them, they vet very, very well, but you have to be careful about things like these news groups or like this Susie Q's coding blog. So you might research a code, type it into Google, you pull something up and here's this blog and it says, oh yes, Susie Q. And she's a certified coder and she has this blog and she gives you all this information. But the problem is, you know, you don't, you could start up a blog in 2 minutes. It takes no time to go onto WordPress and start up a blog and call it the Super Real American, you know, certified coder blog and post anything up there. I could start one in the next 5 minutes and post who knows what that could be not entirely accurate as far as our coding purposes. So what are our authoritative guidance that we know that if we get into an audit or we know we get into legal problems, we can take this to a court of law. We can take this to an auditor and say, this is the guidance and this is what we're following. Well, one for ICD-10-CM is our coding clinic. And coding clinic has been published since 1984. And it brings the latest official coding information to coding professionals, to auditors, to third-party payers, to government agencies and consultants that are interested in and dedicated to improving the accuracy and uniformity of medical coding. So this has been published for quite a few whiles. CMS affirmed it as the official source of coding information, and it is actually noted in the Federal Register in 2009. So this, again, you can take this to court, you can hand this to your lawyer, it is official guidance for coding and reporting. So ICD-10-CM and actually PCS, which is our inpatient system, they have both coding clinics. And this is published by the American Hospital Association. There's great software you can purchase, few hundred dollars a year usually to have this added into maybe an encoder program or to purchase it, or you can go right through their website and get all that information and guidance. I highly suggest that you get something that's maybe an add-on to a code search tool that you have, so, because they make it so intuitive now that you can type in a diagnosis code and it'll go, hey, there's a coding clinic reference for this, and you can click that and it'll lead you right to it, or you can search the database of coding clinics and find one of the references on it. So if you're looking in your ICD-10-CM book and you go, oh, there's some guidance about this, I should maybe check that out. You can go right into there and look and find out what is that official guidance. So it's a lot of things like common errors, common questions. They give clinical scenarios that say like, hey, if the patient has this diagnosis and this diagnosis, or it's this situation, this is how you code it. You know, maybe you don't use an unspecified code, you use this, or you do use an unspecified code. So that is an official resource and official guidance to the classification when we don't have like that further direction within ICD-10-CM. And then another authoritative guidance is our information from Medicare. So if we are a Medicare provider, we have to follow Medicare's rules when billing to Medicare. But it's important to also remember that there are different Medicare contractors. So each of these different contractors, which are broken down based off of region, may have different interpretations or ways that they follow Medicare's guidelines. So for example, I have a lot of great coding friends down in Florida and I'm in Pennsylvania. So if I'm talking to my friends in Florida when they're in a different jurisdiction, so I'm in this JL Novitas area, they're in JNFCSO. Now my wonky Novitas area has this weird rule, for example, in evaluation and management coding with detailed exams, and they call it this 4x4 exam rule, where in order to get a detailed exam, for the ones where you still count exam for your calculation, you have to have 4 different body areas or 4 different organ systems and document 4 elements of them. So pupils are equal, they're round, they're reactive to light and accommodation. That would be one body organ with 4 different elements. And I would need 4 of those to get that 4x4 detailed exam. So if I was talking to one of my friends in Florida and we were looking at a case and I'm going, oh yeah, you have to have the 4x4 exam and it didn't meet this detailed exam, I only got a 99213. They might, or well, it wouldn't be 99213 anymore because we code office outpatients. I only got a 99221 and they got a 99223. And I'm looking at that and going, well, why are you coding it this way? Why are you coding it that way? It's because I have different regulations. And while that might be the source of truth for me in Pennsylvania, it's not going to be the same for them in Florida. So that sometimes can get confusing, especially with providers talking to each other. Very similar situations. Your friends in Florida might have totally different coverage determinations, that they might have certain diagnoses that are covered in their territory that aren't in yours, just because of those different interpretations of those Medicare guidelines for those jurisdictions. So, you know, that's another thing to even just think about on social media. Someone might tell you something and they think absolutely 110% this is the correct way to do it. And it might be in their area, maybe not in yours, because maybe even the scope of practice might be different in your state versus theirs. So, action plan, what are the things that we need to think about? If you have reference sheets, if you have listings of diagnosis codes or things that you have printed out or saved, make sure you're checking those, that they are up to date. You're verifying them annually. Then you're looking at this and going, oh, you know what? This code was deleted last year. We need to update it. I would suggest at least annually looking at those reference sheets, or sometimes people call them cheat sheets. There's some strong opinions about the thought process of calling them cheat sheets, reference sheets. So if you have things that you're like, yeah, we know these are the things that are covered, we have this little reference sheet that we use, make sure that you're at least checking that annually to make sure that nothing was taken off of it, that the codes haven't changed, that maybe the coverage policies haven't changed. Make sure that you're using those guidance from authoritative sources. So our CMS, our payer guidelines. So I can look up some of the different payer guidelines for my area, like Highmark or Aetna, and making sure that if I'm looking to review a patient's documentation and say, hey, do they have one of these covered diagnoses for these, that I'm looking at that official policy that we have. And of course, not manipulating the data and going, oh, I'm just going to pick one off of the list to make sure it gets covered, but actually verifying the documentation, looking at that coverage, and making sure that we use that authoritative guidance. So our payer contracts, our CMS guidance, our local coverage determinations from our local Medicare contractors, and then things like our coding clinics and our actual ICD-10-CM books. Now you have to be careful because sometimes not all payers will follow the exact guidance that they should. And that's something that you have to kind of fight with maybe at the back end. Get education in preparation of the ICD-10-CM code updates. So October 1st of every year is when they update ICD-10. So in the September timeframe, you should be looking to get a webinar or an update or something with your ICD-10-CM changes. You know, that might mean that you have to change maybe a favorite code. You might have some data files that need to get uploaded to your practice management systems. And you want to make sure that if there's something that's a code that you use frequently that's changed, you know exactly what you're doing with that. So October 1, they all change. Look to at least by September, start getting some education for you or your coders. Or if you're a coder, you should be looking for education a little bit prior to that. They publish the changes. And again, the nice thing about ICD-10-CM is it's publicly available. So it's not like you have to buy a book. You should be able to find that information on CMS or the CDC. They publish the whole information on the ICD-10-CM. You can go on there and download the guidelines. You can download the code sets. Review your documentation for coding gaps. So have a random sample reviewed, see where those gaps are, you know, where you're maybe able to select something of a higher specificity, but a generic code was utilized, or even things like, you know, during a really good intense coding review, they can look at things like maybe the prescriptions the patients are getting, any equipment that they're having, services they're receiving, and going, hey, you know, this was reported on as unspecified, but I think they might have something that's a little bit higher risk going on here. Have regular audits and follow-up education from a certified coder. You know, I think it's important to use certified coders, and especially domestic certified coders. I'm a little bit of a nuance about that, because I think those coding exams are tough, right? They're very tough, and they're designed specifically to be tough because we know the impact that incorrect coding can have on bottom lines. So have those regular audits and that follow-up education from a certified coder to say, hey, you know, in these areas where maybe you didn't meet the criteria, here's why, and then develop that action plan of how we can correct it from there. Is it that you just need to tweak your documentation? Is it something in the EMR? And then make that action plan from there. So again, my name is Victoria Mold. You can contact me with my email address there. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on YouTube. I am on Instagram and TikTok. Thank you so much. So I'm going to open it up. I haven't seen any questions come in yet, but feel free to ask questions if you have them.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Victoria. So let me just come in. So one of the questions, I just kind of kick it off. So again, everyone, go ahead and submit your questions either in the Q&A box. You can send through chat or raise your hand and we'll bring you in live to ask your question. But first question I wanted to ask you, Victoria, was, you know, one thing that a lot of practices ask about is, you know, getting audited. And there's never really seems to be like a straight answer as to how often you do it. How often should you technically get audited?
So you don't want to find out any surprises when an insurance comes in and audits you, especially Medicare. I've dealt with some pretty tough Medicare audits in the past, especially when they were doing their targeted probe and educate. I would recommend if you're a small practice, you should at least have a few cases, like 10, 15 cases reviewed quarterly. At a bare minimum, it should be annual. But I like quarterly because I think that has a good way that you can put that into like a quarterly meeting that you're having, that if you're having something with your team and going over your statistics, going over your revenue, that you can hand it over to, hey, now let's look at our audits and see where we maybe have some opportunities or where are the things that we can work on.
I'm surprised you're not getting as many questions as I expected. And I think it's because your presentation was extremely, extremely well put together in depth. But I do have some questions myself, just because there are some medical coders that were in the Facebook group that I posted and that couldn't join. So something else I was going to ask you is that with all the changes in the last couple of years, are there like some key hurdles that you feel that most medical coders trip up on that are easily fixable, just whether it's in process or anything related to that?
Yeah, I would say one of the So as medical coders, just like physicians do, we have to get continuing education units. We have to follow up. So I think it's important to keep up with those updates, because I've seen so many coders that they learn something once and then they think it's always like that way, and they don't realize that it's changed at some point in time, a year ago, 2 years ago. And that information that they were told on how to code something and abstract it, or what the interpretation of a certain clinical scenario is, has changed. So keeping up with your CEUs is super, super important. The other thing is really knowing your guidelines. I think there's been so much more focus on diagnosis coding in the past few years. And those of us that have worked in that CPT, that pro-fee world for so long, we've not been as fine-tuned as we could be in them. But now there's just, because of just so many extra bonuses and quality payment incentives, it's really taken more of a forefront. And I think a lot of coders are now realizing they don't know ICD-10-CM maybe to the highest specificity that they thought they did when they were first training to become a certified coder.
Got it. That's actually a pretty good segue to another question is that, you know, for me, fortunately, I was able to find you and your channel, and this has been a fantastic amount of information there. But I feel like there's a lot of, I don't know if they're certified or not, there's a lot of people who are creating content around medical coding. And so, I mean, for me, I always recommend medical coders to go to, you know, your content just because you are certified and you very clearly keep up to date with things. But for yourself, what are some other resources that you feel are probably the best for coders to look to? And maybe not to put anybody in the spot, but what are some things that you would advise against?
So one thing that I think is a great resource, and I loved this when I worked in plastic surgery, the specialty societies oftentimes put out these magazines or notices for that certain specialty that has coding information in it. Like they have vetted these. They've talked to the societies ad nauseum and gone, hey, when we have osteopathic manipulation, this is the way we're going to code it. You know, this is when we're going to bill an E&M out separately. And I think that those specialty societies, coders don't realize that they exist out there, because with plastic surgery, for example, you have to be a member in order to access that. So I would have to ask my physician, hey, I need you to get me your specialty magazine because I want to read those CPT corners that are in there and get that official guidance. So that's a good one. I would just be very cautious of some of the other coding content out there from people who aren't certified coders, because there are people out there that are training people for coding but are actually certified themselves. So just make sure that it, especially if you're looking for education, that it's an AAPC approved or a HEMA approved educator.
Got it. And it looks like we're getting some questions now. They're just piling in. So I think people were a little shy. So you want me to pick one? Do you want to pick one?
Yeah. So I see Nicole is in here and she's asking, how do I get started in HCC coding? It seems as though most companies only want experienced HCC coders. There are some places out there that do internships. And right now I know like Change Healthcare will hire a lot of coders for big projects that they're taking on that sometimes they will take less certified coders. And right now is the big, big boom for risk adjustment projects. So keep your eyes peeled, go to codersdirect.com. They have a lot of listings for coders, and get connected on LinkedIn with those recruiters, that especially people like Change Healthcare, like Weller Healthcare IT, they're posting positions all the time.
Shameless shout out, check gentem.com too, because we need coders.
There you go. And then I have one here. What changes do you see coming with ICD-11? There's a lot more specificity, and it's going to be very intuitive as far as the SNOMED classifications for the diagnosis codes. So it's going to be more so an electronic search database versus having printed books. So I think the EMR integrations was on the forefront of their minds when they developed ICD-11. So it's going to be a lot more search friendly. Now that doesn't mean that you're not going to type in diabetes and 20,000 selections aren't still going to come up. But it's going to match more clinically from what I'm understanding for what is already our EMR functionality. So that was a big part of what they were doing. Someone's asking, do you have any examples for level 3 and 4 in E&M coding as per 2021? I have some E&M coding videos on my YouTube website, and I'm actually planning on doing more. And I do a lot of E&M reviews and audits. If that's something you're interested in having done, you can feel free to reach out about it. But I think when I think of a level 4, my mindset is more to chronic conditions and prescription drug management, because that's like the easiest one to hit a 4, but there's a lot of different ways that you can hit a level 4. And with the technical corrections that the AMA put out recently, I think there's some things that I actually even going in thought maybe were a level 3, but actually now looking at what they're saying will meet different criteria, I'm thinking, oh, this might now hit a level 4.
All right, everyone. So last chance, any other questions, whether you want to raise your hand and ask it live or come on or just submit. Let's see, someone submitted something to the Q&A. They say, hi, good morning, and thank you. All right, so not a question, but we'll take it. Well, wonderful. Well, you know, Victoria, thank you so much for coming on and just sharing such a wealth of knowledge and a fantastic presentation. For all of you who have joined live, again, you're going to be getting this recording soon, within the next couple of days. We'll also publish this audio on our podcast. And again, probably in the next week or so, I'll be publishing a separate interview that I did with Victoria, which is really fantastic, especially for you coders who are looking to break into the field, and for the more, I guess, tenured coders to pick up some great tips and tricks. So with that being said, my name is Omar Khatib. I'm the head of growth. Oh, wait, we got one question. Chelsea just snuck it right in. Okay.
Yeah.
You see that one, Victoria?
Yeah. Is there a resource coders can use to determine whether risk adjustment diagnoses are acute or chronic? It would have, so the definition of acute or chronic, so it has to be in the provider documentation if it is acute or if it's chronic. You can't assume that if they just say on their kidney disease or asthma that it's an acute or it's a chronic. It has to specify in the documentation. Another thing worth noting is that a lot of the ICD-10-CM manuals now, if you look up a diagnosis code, it'll have a little icon on there that says HCC so that you know it's a risk adjusted diagnosis.
Very nice. Well, we got it. So everyone, the moment I say that we're about to end the live, everyone's like, oh, let me ask questions. Okay, questions now, because we do have to let Victoria go, but Salima has a question. Chelsea, thanks for that. Salima does have a question.
The site that you can go that just has coding jobs is codersdirect.com. And it sounds like Genta might be having some positions available as well there.
Yes, definitely check us out. And I just shared the codersdirect.com with all attendees. I think that was it. And small little thing I have to tell all the attendees. Again, I'm a big fan of Victoria. I think her content is fantastic. Aside from following her online, two things that I do recommend doing, because it helps you not miss the content, is on YouTube and on LinkedIn. Aside from following her, make sure you turn on your notifications. I know for her LinkedIn lives, she does them on the weekends. You can turn your notifications on so you're aware when they come on and you can join her live. And same with YouTube. I recommend it. Subscribe and turn the notifications on. Otherwise, you miss a lot of content, and then it takes a while to catch up. So small tip to everybody. All right. Well, thank you all for joining again. Webinar will go out soon to everybody via email. Again, if you have a practice that you would like to recommend to Gentem, if they become a customer, then we give you $1,000 from us. Just go to gentem.com and sign up through the demo. And we do a free benchmark assessment. Thank you all for joining. This is another Gentem practice growth webinar series. Thank you, Victoria, for joining us. Stay on for a second. I'll chat with you, and we'll see you all next time.